meeting for Health and Social Services at 1:30. All members are present. Senator Dyson, Senator Eaton, Senator Ellis, and Senator Myers, and myself, Chair Betty Davis. We have two bills to come before us today. The order of the bills being heard is Senate Bill 14. Today we will get an overview of Senate Bill 14. I'm going to ask the sponsor or any staff to come forward, and I want to welcome everybody that's here for the meeting. We will take Senate Bill 5 up after the overview of this Bill 14. Senate 14, and it's Senator Dyson's bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome.
Senator Fred Dyson, and with me is my Chief of Staff, Charles Cobb. And we appreciate the committee taking up the bill. I got started on this visiting a pharmacist, and the pharmacist was frustrated and angry, and I said, "What's going on?" And the pharmacist said, "I hate this time of the month because new eligibility's up, people who are on public Medicaid show up and get a bottle of OxyContin with 30, 40, 60 pills in it, pay their $2 copay, and off they go with a smile." And this pharmacist said, you know, "I know this isn't just for them." And last fall, I don't know what this is today, but last fall, one pill of OxyContin was selling for $85 on the streets at Anchorage. And I'm told that folks who are misusing prescription drugs have figured out a way to both smoke it and to shoot it. And a couple of times I've used OxyContin, oral surgery, I didn't get a buzz out of it, but apparently some folks do. So that's what got me started on doing the research on this. And I'll just read you some excerpts from the sponsor statement. "This purpose of this bill is to provide for the protection and reasonable accommodation of a health care provider's expression of professional conscience in the provision of health care services." There's just an extraordinary explosion of new treatments and pharmacy agents to treat all kinds of things. "Health care providers' view of health, sickness, and patient care and purpose of medicine comprise a well-informed professional conscience. This conscience is charged with new information and new technology, changed with new technology. A broad application of the right of conscience applies to the issues of end-of-life care, consumer genetic testing, the practice of pain management, psychotropic drugs use, sterilization, race-specific medications, infant circumcision, physician and nurse complicity in capital punishment, physician-assisted suicide, abortion, etc. This bill recognizes societal benefits that divergent organizational identities bring. The relational dimension of professional conscience between healthcare institution and providers, between providers and patients, and between providers and communities. This helps to ensure the conditions necessary for the conversations of conscience to continue concerning the healthcare profession. Many states have laws protecting conscious right of healthcare providers. Alaska's law does not currently provide a general healthcare provider for protection of conscience. This bill provides the guarantee of exercise of healthcare provider conscience in an increasingly pluralistic environment. All healthcare providers must be treated equally and must have recourse to the exceptions made for conscience. I think you'll find this bill quite well crafted and provides the several exceptions that are needed. And I'm going to have my assistant, Mr. Cobb, both go through the sectional analysis if you choose and answer any questions.
Yes, I would like for your aide to go through the bill. Your name again?
Yes, Senator Chairwoman Davis. My name is Charles Cobb. Thank you. The bill, as Senator Dyson has said, is to protect health care provider conscience, and I'll start with the, this is a single section bill, and I'll give a summary through it. The first part there, the top of section 1, line 6, provides within Alaska statutes, Title 18, a protection and reasonable accommodation for a healthcare provider's expression of conscience pertaining to a provision of a healthcare service. And it establishes that written notice is the method of communicating an expression of conscience, and states that the employer will reasonably accommodate and not discriminate against employees who provide this notice. Down at line over the next page, page 2 of the bill, top of that page, it provides that the notice does not have to include the reason for the objection, but it must be related to the healthcare provider's conscience, and it cannot be based on a protected class of the patient. It goes further to provide that an employer is not required to accommodate the employee if the employer demonstrates that the accommodation poses an undue hardship or the objecting employee is the only healthcare provider available in a life-threatening circumstance, and that the healthcare provider may not refuse to provide health treatment in a life-threatening circumstance until an alternate healthcare provider is available. And it concludes with providing civil and criminal immunity to healthcare providers who express conscience in compliance with this section. And it provides that this section and the terms in it will be construed in a manner consistent with Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And then it defines terms. That is the brief overview of the bill.
Okay, thank you for the sectional review. Are there any questions that any of the committee members need to ask of the sponsor or the staff that just gave the overview of Senate Bill 14? Apparently we have none at this time.
Madam Chair?
I'm sorry, I didn't see your hand. Senator Meyer?
I just thought of the question. Thank
okay.
you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, a question I have and a concern is that in some of the rural areas where you have only one health care provider, if that person, for whatever reason, refused to do a procedure, where would this person go? I guess they'd have to fly somewhere else, or do you have any answer to that?
Well, I'll take a stab at it. Thank you, Senator Meyer. If it's a life-threatening situation, they must provide. And what we don't want to do is get into a situation where we have a very qualified provider and so on, and they just refuse to do cosmetic surgery, and so on and so forth. This thing's a waste of refuge, particularly for public money. Then they say no, but there is an alternative for it. I think Mr. Bocock, any other answers?
Yeah. What this bill recognizes, is, particularly as Senator Dyson started at the beginning, it recognizes the relational dimension in the whole discussion of conscience in communities and the healthcare providers that are there. We could have a situation in rural Alaska, you mentioned rural, where a healthcare provider is providing 99.99% of all requested healthcare services, and maybe there is one specific request that that healthcare provider does not want to provide. We don't want a situation where that healthcare provider literally shut down, not allowed to exercise their conscience and provide all the healthcare services they are because there's a request for a specific service that is going to be referred away to another provider. It's important with conscience that those things are discussed with the patients, the community that you serve, and certainly we all recognize that the collective community conscience in Wasilla Palmer is different than in Anchorage, a little bit different than in Juneau, a little bit different. Kenai Peninsula, but we all have our community dynamics, and so we all have a little bit different philosophies in our healthcare institutions.
And I might add, by and large, what this bill accomplishes is not thought to be very necessary by doctors. They're, as you would know, Madam Chair, they're kind of at the top of the medical food chain, and they feel they, by and large, do what they want and do it. But very good friend of mine, we were undergraduates together 100 years ago. He's an internist, virtually all his patients in the ICU unit. He found one of the heart medications that the hospital approved of and most insurance company, he was losing patients. He had four or five of them die, and he quit using it and used another one that was highly recommended in the literature and hasn't had a fatality at probably 24 months now. It was against policy, against what the insurance company, but his professional judgment was What he was being pushed to use wasn't the best thing for his patients, and he just said, "Phooey, I'm going to do what I think is best." And we want him to have that kind of thing. There's a doctor in Calgary who, in under the Canadian system, the person that gets the services is the next one in the queue. He was a 58-year-old alcoholic, had already ruined two kidneys, and he was next in line to get a new one. The doc says, "I'm not doing it. There's younger people here whose behavior is not going to destroy a kidney, and I'm going to not going to give it to this alcoholic." You know, and the last I heard, and I'm out of date now, he was in the process of losing his license for, you know, not doing it. I don't think that would happen in our country, but it's the kind of thing that is pretty scary to us if we don't allow the medical providers to use their best judgment.
Any other comments or questions at this point? I do want to say, for the sake of the committee, I want you to know that I did have research to gather information for us, and we haven't had time to distribute that to the members of the committee. But I'm going to make sure that you get copies of it so that you may review the material and see what other states have done with similar bills, or that you might come up with any questions or concerns that you might have. You may get them to my office, or you might speak with the sponsor himself. But as I said, there is no public testimony on the bill. There is Dr. Holbert. Burt is here for questions only, not to speak to either one of the bills, but for questions, if you have a question of him. And if not, I want to thank the sponsor of the bill for bringing it forth. You have a closing comment?
In the package you've got, there should be a strong letter of endorsement from the State Pharmacy Board and a letter from Bill Reisinger, a medical doctor, and
we have both.
And from Dr. Wells, who's on the dental board. And
Reisinger's on the last medical board.
Dr. Reisinger's on the state medical board in support.
Thank you. That's been distributed to the members.
Yeah, thank
already.
You.
And I'll also provide you with a copy of the Laird Research report.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We're going to set this bill aside, and now we're going to move to Senate Bill 5. And probably everybody in the room know what Senate Bill 5 is, the Denali Kid Care Bill, which was before us last year. And sure enough, the bill did pass both houses last year. And now it's back before us because it was vetoed by the governor. I'm going to call my aide, Tom Overmeyer, up to give an overview of the bill, and we will begin taking public testimony if there's time left after we get this through the discussion with the members. Senator Overmeyer.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tom Overmeyer, aide to Senator Davis. The bill before you is Senate Bill 5. It's an act relating to eligibility requirements for medical assistance for certain children and pregnant women and providing for an effective date. This is, in fact, the same bill that was introduced under Senate Bill 13 last year, which had overwhelming support in both houses, as indicated by the Senate and House journals on the dates of passage. It was vetoed on June 4th, 2010. The bill, and there have been new fiscal notes that have been issued. In Section 1, amends the medical assistance for persons under 19 years of age and for pregnant women by increasing the household limits from 175 to 200% of the federal poverty guideline. In Section 2, it increases the household limit from 175 to 200% federal poverty guideline for requiring premiums and cost-sharing contributions from medical assistance recipients who are under 19 years of age. And it, in Section 3, provides for an immediate effective date. This bill restores to original levels established 14 years ago the qualifying income eligibility to 200% federal poverty guideline for the state's children insurance program, SCHIP, called Denali Kid Care in Alaska. Alaska is one of the nation's wealthiest states, is only one of four states which funds its S-CHIP program below 200%. This bill makes health insurance accessible to an estimated 1,277 more uninsured children and 225 pregnant women in Alaska. Denali Kid Care is an enhanced Medicaid reimbursement program receiving up to 70% federal matching funds. I believe that the current level is 65% federal matching funds, as largely indicated by your fiscal, your three fiscal notes that were just issued. Denali Kid Care serves an estimated 7,900 Alaska children and remains one of the least costly medical assistance programs in the state at about $1,700 per child with full coverage, including dental care, which is about 20% of the cost of adult senior coverage. Early intervention and preventative care will greatly increase Alaska children's health and yield substantial savings to the state and public and private sector hospital emergency rooms, which must admit indigent and uninsured patients for non-emergency treatment. It is estimated per the Kaiser Foundation that 24,000 uninsured children in Alaska with a medical need are five times as likely not to have a regular doctor as insured children and four times more likely to use emergency rooms at a much higher cost. A similar bill was overwhelmingly passed in 2010. As I indicated, it was vetoed by the governor because he indicated it might require an increase in state-funded induced terminations of pregnancies. Medicaid funds 51% of all births in Alaska. Interestingly, it's about 48% nationwide. In order to continue to receive federal funding for the state Medicaid program, of which Denali Kid Care is part, and in order to comply with state law, constitutional provisions, and the Alaska Supreme Court rulings, the state must provide medical services for pregnant women, including medically necessary terminations, as well as prenatal and postpartum care. The Alaska Department of Health and Social Services estimated that no more than 10% or 22 more induced terminations would result with minimal expense from the increase in eligibility for Denali Kid Care to 200% federal poverty guideline. Induced terminations under the entire Denali Kid Care program cost about $384,000 annually, or less than 0.18% or one-fifth of 1% of the $217 million Denali Kid Care budget. While the governor understandably is concerned about mushrooming costs of state Medicaid program, Denali Kid Care, which is a small fraction or 18% of the $1.2 billion total state Medicaid budget, should not be among the first cuts at the expense of Alaska's most vulnerable children and pregnant women. Increasing eligibility to 200% under Senate Bill 5 is uncomplicated, manageable, and could take effect immediately with prompt implementation by DHSS. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
You've heard the sponsor's statement, and if you would like, be willing to walk through the bill. I want to hear what the desire of the committee is, or would they prefer to have the public testimony begin and ask questions later? Well, what's your pleasure? Don't all of you speak at the same time.
Well, Madam Chair, perhaps some of the questions I have will be addressed through public testimony, so I would just assume wait until after public testimony.
We're really willing to go through the bill, should that be the desire. If not, we'll start with public testimony. I don't have very much before me. We do have Jean Michelle online on the phone for questions only.
Is there any material differences between this and the bill last year?
No.
So I don't need to have this period of sectional analysis.
No, not really, but we can go through the session analysis if anybody wants to. It's pretty much identical to the same bill from last year. At this time, we do have someone here in the audience that want to testify on this bill, and I will call Marie Darling up for her testimony, representing AARP.
I'm Marie Darling. representing the AARP Legislative Task Force here in Juneau. And as we supported this bill last year, we do again this year. And I don't want to take your time going through the full letter, which you have a copy of, but I might just add a little bit more to some of the information that was provided regarding the bill. And so with that, I'll just mention that, let's go back a little bit. A few years ago, I was asked when I was testifying for Denali Kid Care, by one of the representatives, I don't remember whether it was a senator or a representative, why AARP was interested in Denali Kid Care. And at that time, my response was that we are a large organization of grandparents, and therefore we are interested in whatever pertains to children and so forth. And so I want to just reiterate that AARP is one of the world's largest organizations of grandparents. And I want to give you a few statistics just to kind of fill in from what Mr. Obermeyer said, that we have many grandparents who are raising their grandchildren, and I'm sure many of you know of these situations. As of October 2007, and this is about the most recent figures that we have, Alaska had 8,188 children living in grandparent-headed households. That's 4.3% of all the children in the state. And of the children living in households headed by grandparents in Alaska, 5,110 are living there without either parent present. 5,419 grandparents report they are responsible for their grandchildren living with them. 67.4% of those grandparents are under the age of 60. Many of them still in the workforce. And this tells you what some of the concerns are then. We have grandparents still working, but also raising their grandchildren. And 11.5% of these grandparents live below the federal poverty level. Now that gives you some idea of the grandchildren that would be helped then by a change in the Denali Kid Care. And as we know, this only raises it back to what the previous poverty level was a few years ago. And so we really are asking that you support this bill, because as we know then, there are thousands of children who would otherwise be uninsured and would be receiving their health care with this program. And so I think that's about all I want to add, that other than the fact that there are still many children out there still remaining without health care. So therefore, we do support the bill and urge your support.
All right, thank you. Any questions? We thank you as usual for your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you.
Randy Sweet, United Way. Are you there, Randy?
I'm here and available for questions if anyone has.
Are you only for questions?
Yes.
Representing United Way?
Okay.
All right. Elizabeth Ripley?
Yes, this is Elizabeth.
Do you plan to testify today?
I do plan to testify. Thank you for the opportunity.
Yes. Okay. You want to state your name for the record?
Driving. Okay.
Okay, you may go ahead, Elizabeth. State your name for the record and who you represent.
Elizabeth Ripley with the Mass Health Foundation.
You may give your testimony.
Senator Davis, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today on Senate Bill 5. The Mattsu Health Foundation is a 501c3 that owns part of the Mattsu Regional Medical Center. And we use the revenues we earn from our local hospital to make grants to improve the health of Mattsu residents. Our mission is to improve the health and wellness of Alaskans that are living in Mattsu. And we have a goal to be the healthiest borough in the state of Alaska. We have four strategies to reach this goal. and one of those strategies is to reduce barriers to healthcare access. And we've spent quite a bit of time and analysis to determine what those barriers are. And, of course, lack of health insurance is one of those barriers to access. Health is, in part, determined by access to primary, behavioral, and dental care and preventive services. In 2007, of the 22,991 children in MATSU, approximately 6.5%, or almost 1,500 of them, were uninsured. However, a startling 650 of these children fell below 200% of the federal poverty level. And as you're probably aware, the rate of uninsured children is higher the closer we get to the federal poverty level, whereas the overall uninsured rate of children in MATSU was 6.5%, as I said, the rate for children at or below 200% of the federal poverty level was 20.4% in 2007, the latest data that I was able to get. Since Alaska decreased the eligibility for Denali KidCare, the rate of uninsured children within or close to the federal poverty level has grown each year by 1 or 2 percentage points. And Alaska has also seen a 31% decline in the number of children covered by private health insurance in the past decade. The cost of caring for uninsured children is passed on to other Alaskans and businesses, raising premiums and out-of-pocket expenses for everyone. But it's not just a cost on the payment side. As other speakers have testified, uninsured children are 9 times less likely to have a regular doctor, 4 times more likely to be taken to emergency rooms, and 25% more likely to miss school than insured children. They're not as healthy as children who have regular access. Without insurance, parents often delay care, delay going to the doctor until the situation becomes emergent. We're all concerned about the rate of Medicaid cost growth in our state. And one way to get a handle on this is to address chronic disease and other drivers at the primary care level, to stay on top with prevention and maintenance of health. These children who are uninsured don't have this opportunity and cost the system much more on the other end. And I'll give you an example. I was speaking recently with a mother who had a child with asthma. She took him to the emergency room 12 times year before last, but only 3 times last year. The difference? Access to primary care and preventative information, techniques, and treatment. Increasing Denali KidCare income eligibility levels to at least 200% of the federal poverty level will increase health care access for children and families at this criterion. It will improve the public health and overall health outcomes for Alaskan children. And as you're probably aware, CHIPRA reauthorized and expands the state Children's Health Insurance Program of 1997 to allow states to implement coverage up to 300% of the federal poverty level. And we have been fortunate to earn some of those performance bonuses by increasing enrollment through other strategies, but we're running out of strategies without addressing eligibility. And I believe this year our performance bonus was over $4 million to the state. We are one of a tiny majority of states with eligibility levels as low as 175%. So in summary, and I will follow up and put my statistics and comments to each of you in writing, but in summary, the MATSU Health Foundation board has passed a resolution. We support and advocate for Denali KidCare income eligibility level to be increased to at least 200% of the federal poverty level. And we would advocate that a cost-sharing option is considered above 200% of the federal poverty level. And we wholeheartedly support Senate Bill 5.
Thanks for your testimony. Are there any questions? Hearing no questions. Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify to Senate Bill 5? I do want to go on record to say that the commissioner is present, and so is the deputy commissioner here. They are here for questions only, not to speak to the bill. Now back to the members. Is there anyone online or anybody else signed up? No? Senator Marr.
Did you say the commissioner is available for questions?
He's in the audience. He didn't come to testify, but I guess he's interested in this bill and he wants to hear what's being said, so we'll call him up.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Commissioner Schumer.
Good afternoon, Commissioner.
Good afternoon.
Commissioner Sherwood.
Commissioner, I guess I'm a little confused here because, you know, I think we all on this committee and certainly you guys all want to provide as much health care as we can for women and children in need. But if this bill's essentially the same bill as last year and it was vetoed last year, is it destined for the same fate?
Senator Meyer, through the chair, it is essentially the same bill as was introduced last year that the governor vetoed, yes.
And if I can follow up?
You may continue.
So would we expect the same fate then as last year's bill? I mean, I'm assuming the governor wants to be consistent, but I don't know. Have you had any discussion?
Senator Meyer, through the chair, we have had discussions on the bill. And the department is vigorously trying to find a middle ground, walking a fence, if you will, to allow the bill to go forward.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Yeah, I appreciate that comment because I thought that was the intent all along was to, you know, go ahead and bring this up to the 200%, but find some way of carving out the portion that is of concern to the governor and some of the legislators. But as of right now, we haven't found that mechanism yet or that carving out or that compromise, I guess.
Senator Meyer, through the chair, we have not come to a meeting of the minds as to what that solution is at this point.
Madam Chair?
Senator, you have something else to say?
If I may.
Sure.
So are these great minds talking? I'm not included, but that's okay. I'm not a great mind, I guess. But as long as the people are talking, that's all that matters.
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, you'd be welcome to join us. But we are talking, yes, sir.
Okay, very good. May I continue with another question, Madam Chair?
Yes, it may.
Okay. The new federal health care plan program that was passed, the one with 1,100 pages that is questionable whether everybody's read or not, How would that new program affect Denali KidCare and providing services for the needy and children and pregnant women? Is there any impact? Frankly, I haven't read the 1,100 pages either, so I can't say.
Senator Meyer, through the chair, I hate to say this, but I have read the 1,100 pages, and I think it's closer to 1,248, but who's counting?
Okay.
The bill, the Affordable Care Act, does not affect this population that we're talking about between 175 and 200%. What it does affect is all those below 138% of poverty level. And so it will expand Medicaid itself by, I believe, about 32,000 lives. But this population that we're talking about with regards to Senate Bill 5 is not affected to any great extent in this.
The chair, for the record, I'm John Sherwood with the Department of Health and Social Services. There is essentially a maintenance of effort requirement for this through 2019. Kind of after the CHIP authorization is actually not even authorized that far, but there was a maintenance of effort provision. Basically, long term, there's no definite future for the CHIP program for children. But in the near term, it's pretty much business as usual for this group.
Okay.
Other question?
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, I should know this answer. Maybe you can just kind of rehearse it for me. But ultimately, where does the money come from that funds Denali KidCare? Who pays? Is it federal taxpayers, state taxpayers?
It's Senator Dyson, through the chair, it will come through the SCHIP authorization, which is 75% federal, 25% state, 50-50.
Through the chair, it's currently 65%. Federal is the basic CHIP funding formula. For clarification, when you look at our fiscal notes, it's actually blended funding. Tribal health care provided to tribal members through tribal health care providers is 100% federally funded. We can take essentially that funding first. The CHIP is 65%, and then for the expanded coverage of pregnant women under Medicaid, if it's not tribal, it would be 50% federal. So when you look at our fiscal notes, what you're looking at is a blending of the different claiming rates we have access to, depending on who's being served and where they're being served. So
I may continue. I think I have one more question. Yes, so either the federal taxpayers subsidize the health care for this population, or the state ones, which largely is oil revenues. Did I understand you to imply that there's no guarantee that the federal program will continue indefinitely? It's subject to year-by-year funding appropriations.
Through the chair, the program, the CHIP program, is authorized, I believe, through 2015. I would have to check. There is reference in the bill to certain maintenance of effort provisions through 2019, but this is not, there are limits in the statute to the current authorization. It's not uncommon for federal programs aren't authorized indefinitely. They come up for reauthorization, and this the CHIP program is one of them that would come up for reauthorization.
That raises another question, if I may.
You may ask another question, Senator Dyson.
There's no requirement that Congress fund it, is there? I mean, they could defund any or portion of it, could they not? I'm just worried in these tight federal budgets what might happen.
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, the CHIP program is funded through authorizations or allocations to states, and I believe Congress has discretion as to what is allocated.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm out to assure you that the program was just renewed just last year, year before last, when they renewed it. So if it goes to 2019, we're in good shape, and we're only asking the state to pay 25%. I don't think we have to be concerned about where we will be able to continue should they drop it. I doubt very seriously that the federal government is going to drop the program altogether, but neither of us can answer that question. We're state legislators, not U.S. Congress or senators. And that's, you know, that's something they would have control over. But they support those program bases, and I don't expect for them to go away. And I don't think we should have that as a holdup as to why we should not fund it, simply for what might happen in 2020. And we know it's good, at least until that time, 2019.
If I may respond.
Yes.
That's not where I was going in my thinking. I think that some of the funding may indeed be jeopardized on the federal level, and that we ought to be looking for another way to take care of this issue.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, and the other way might be us, the state.
Yes, ma'am.
Because, and then the travel, you know, we have that 100% funding, we can do all that we can to encourage people to go that route so we can get the 100% reimbursement. We're not doing that as well as we should, so that's one way of coming up with additional funding for Denali Kid Care. Did you have a question, Senator Eden?
Yes, thank you, yes. Madam Chair. Just to follow up on way back when Senator Meyer was asking his question, and just to get more simplistic, I mean, we're discussing a bill that I personally believe means a lot to a lot of people in the state, and I'm not part of the negotiating committee. between the legislature and the administration, but, I mean, are we just spinning our wheels here? Are we wasting our time? I mean, is the administration, I mean, doing good faith negotiating with the legislature to try to come to some sort of solution and a compromise on this legislation that means so much to people?
Good question. If they want to respond to that, they may, but I'd like to say prior to their responding is, we understand that this bill, if it goes forward just the way it is and nothing happened, that there's a great possibility that it would be vetoed again. That's all along, my office has been concerned about that. I have been working with the president administration in his position as commissioner and before he was commissioner, and also with the deputy commissioner, trying to come up with ways, and other organizations have given us ideas on what we might be able to do to convince the governor. Not only that, I have met with the governor and want to make a compromise and want to work with this. I feel confident that they're going, confidence that they're going to try to come up with a solution that would be acceptable to him as well as to the governor. If I fail at that, then, you know, there's a possibility that this bill might fail. But I'm going to call on the community and anyone else that's concerned about the health of children in our state to make sure that they follow this bill. And when it gets to the governor, that we have something that he's either going to, and I've already said it, don't want to sign it with your name on it, just let it go into law, whatever he wants to do. But we're not just sitting back. I want you to know that.
Thank you, Madam
Chair. I do want you to know that. We are working.
I appreciate it.
And I'm working with them and hope that we'll come up with a solution.
Thank you.
Yes, Senator Dyson?
Yeah, I think that the governor's support for funding health care for children was it. I mean, he was glad to let the bill go through until he was informed that there was a human rights issue, you know, and that was a problem for him. And I, too, know that he's been working, and the Attorney General office has been working to find a way, you know, to go forward without what he and I happen to consider a very significant human rights issue. And I commend him both for his wanting to see the kids are cared for and his being concerned about human rights. But they're working it.
Are there any other comments from the committee? Here, Donnie, is there anyone in the audience that want to testify? We have no other names. Okay, at this point, I'm not closing public testimony, but we'll end it for today, and I'm going to set this bill aside and bring it back at a later time. And the information that I said I provide to you, we'll see that you get it within the next few days. And we'll also be giving you a list of all the people that support this bill, and I've had no opposition to the bill at this point. With that, the committee is adjourned at 2:00.